For today, I'll just talk a little bit more generally at the beginning about a few observations that I've had, perhaps a little bit about reliability microarray studies. I'll talk about classification problem in general, and then I'll talk more about phenotypes, and then review some literature that are well cited. So I bet you've had some exposure to that, right? Did anyone, maybe Marco or Zach, or talk about like lymphoma studies and so what? Do you remember any other papers that you covered here? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Anything else you remember? Okay. All right. So. Okay. All right. So maybe the stuff that I have is new. Okay. Good. So you probably know all this. It's actually so the cDNA arrays are cheaper, right? So they are used a lot in biological, a lot of biology labs. The ones that I work with, for example, in the new building, they have their own libraries. They print their own. AFI arrays are, I think the consensus is that the AFI arrays are probably the most accurate at this point, but it's still, $8,000 to $1,000 per array. A lot of groups are experimenting with these printed oligonucleotide arrays. So Agilent has, so there are just a whole variety now. Agilent has one type of platform where they actually, give you the chips, and you have to basically buy their whole setup. And it's cheaper. People seem to like it, but who knows what's going to happen in the future. I mean, it's all unclear at this point exactly what platform is the best, information per dollar spent. But there are other companies that will actually make these oligonucleotides, and then you just buy those, and then you print it yourself. So you just have those, spray printers, and then print those. I think those will run, at this point, maybe a third of a AFI cost. So that's a good option for the future. But it's not clear how good those are. So, it's cheaper at this point, but not as good. We're actually trying to print that at the Harvard Partners Center ourselves. And so if we can get that to work, we're doing it for human and mouse at this point. If we can get that to work, that would be, very, very good for our investigators. SAGE is a very accurate way of doing expression data analysis. It basically involves sequencing every little tag. So advantage is that you get a very, even for a very small copy number of transcripts, you can get them accurately. The upside is, of course, or the downside is that it's expensive. But there are a bunch of groups around here that have large libraries. So I'm personally interested in the second point, which is nowadays called systems biology. So that is integrating a lot of high-throughput technologies in genomics and proteomics and putting that together. So microarray is where everyone started. Now that all these other technologies are getting more mature, we're all interested in combining all those. And there are a lot of public and commercial tools tools and databases that you should be aware of. So I think the problem is that even the best biologists don't know what's out there. So the challenge for me and a lot of other people in a similar situation is that you have to, instead of assuming that they know what's out there, you have to kind of tell them what to do. Tell the biologist that, you should try such and such because they're just unaware of what's going on in bioinformatics generally. So in terms of data integration, initially, people did a lot of expression data studies. There have been some nice programs that link literature. For example, we just at the center just got a commercial license to something called Ingenuity. You basically put your expression data into the software, and it will generate nice networks. And you can, well, there are many ways of viewing this data, but you can, for example, click on links between genes, and it will bring up all literature related that cite those genes. I mean, there are lots of programs that do that, but this particular program does it really well. So You know, something like that is enormously helpful if you know that such things exist and if you have access to it. There are some free ones out there, but they're just not as good. I mean, this software, they have tons of people, not tons, a lot of people just sitting there curating literature by hand, and so they've accumulated this huge database. But I think that's, eventually, this is, I think, how a lot of us are going to do research. So, you know, these tools will get smarter and smarter, so you don't have to, you know, go through PubMed yourself. There are other types of data. I don't know if you've actually covered any of these in class, but there's a lot of protein DNA binding data. The most famous data set is from the Whitehead, from Rick Young's lab, where for yeast, they basically took all the transcription factors, about a little more than 100 for yeast, and then they found where in the genome these transcription factors actually bind, so in vivo. So they can't locate, you don't have enough resolutions to pinpoint exactly where, you know, what base pair they are binding, but you know which genes are actually using these transcription factors, you know, for their regulation. So, you know, that data is enormously useful. I think they're trying to do that for humans, human genome, but I don't know how well that's going. Protein microarrays, so that has not been as successful as people initially thought it would be. There are just a lot of difficulties in just manufacturing. But for example, at the center, Harvard Partner Center, there's some contract with some company that make these protein arrays with about 50 or 60 just molecules sitting there. And then, you know, these, I guess these are 50 or 60 really common sort of antibody detection systems. So I think that could be very helpful. But I think the technology is still not quite there, at least not for the price that's reasonable for most investigators. Mass spec, that's an enormous area that has taken off in the past, I'd say, at least in terms of informatics, maybe just past year or two. There are enormous amounts of data and a lot of informatics challenges. And so, another sort of set of data that could be integrated into your studies. So there, you know, when people talk about systems biology, people mean different things, but generally they refer to the fact that you're combining all these different types to generate some coherent picture. And it's actually really hard, and I think some of the reasons will be clear in the next few slides. Okay, so let me just skip that. So just to give you a funny story on sort of, you know, the necessity for a good analysis with all this data, there was a well-cited paper in Nature Genetics in 2001 called Transcriptional Regulation and Function During the Human Cell Cycle. So I think it actually came from the group that did the yeast cell cycle a couple of years back prior to that. And in that paper, they claimed that there are a large number of mammalian genes, about 700, that have cell cycle-specific patterns. So I think this was done on AFI data, actually. The next year, there's a paper in GNAS called Analysis of Cell Cycle-Specific Gene Expression in Human Cells as Determined by Microarrays and Double Thymidine Block Synchronization. So from the title, you can't really tell what this, you know, what the subject is, but basically what they did in the 2002 paper is go back and reanalyze the data from 2001 paper. And so if you look at the text here, the original microarray data presented to support the existence of cyclic or gene expression in human cells is now re-examined with a statistical approach. We find that there is internal evidence implying that the original microarray data do not support the proposed patterns of gene expression. Okay. So they, one of these, I think it was the first author, that's a statistician. So they claim that, so to study the cell cycle, you need to synchronize at the beginning, right, using some, you know, one of many methods. then they, you know, look at this data and say, well, you know, after randomizing data, we still see a bunch of genes that have cyclic behavior. And in fact, you know, if you study carefully, cells are not even synchronized. So they claim that the first experiment was just junk, right? And the 700 genes that they observed was something that just could have come by chance, right? Because you, I mean, because you have so many genes, you're going to see some genes that go in cycles. Okay, so it came out in PNAS. And so since then, at least, you know, there were just back and, you know, exchanges back and forth, right? So the first group, you know, has a website that details, like, this is what we did, this is what the PNAS paper did, and this is why they're wrong, just, you know, whole website. And I think this, the second guys also had a rebuttal to that website. So, it was, right, I mean, this is a, you know, important thing to settle, right, because, you know, it came out in Nature Genetics, a lot of people are using this data, but the other group says this is all nonsense. And I think, I mean, so I read through a little bit of that. I think what happened was, I mean, as usual, the truth is somewhere in between. I mean, the first group was so, you know, interested in showing that there are lots of genes that are cycling that they just, you know, use methods that will be advantageous to them. And the second paper, they were so interested in showing that the data was wrong that they defined things in such a way that there would be no, you know, cycling genes. So.
If you found the same genes in another
thing,
yeah, that
might be a little stronger. Maybe, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I bet depending on how you do it, I would think that, you know, they would find some overlap with the first one, but not 700, right? So yeah. So I guess the lesson is that you should, you know, make sure you do things well before you publish. At least in such a way that, you know, no one can attack you like this. And this is just one example. There are a lot of problems with early studies, and I'll actually tell you about another problem that has been very common. So one thing that I've been interested in with a student who actually published a paper on this before anyone else. So there are substantial differences in different technologies for microarray platforms, right? So, you know, cDNAs, you know, they're very different from AFI arrays. So, you know, a lot of the, one of the common questions is what platform should I use, right? If something's cheaper, does it work as well? Do they agree? So which platform is the best? And so there are a bunch of papers on this, some of which are cited in the review article. But I mean, that's just a very small subset. And most of them are conflicting, except that, you know, they agree that they do not agree very well. Okay, so it's, they're conflicting in terms of, you know, which one is better, you know, how accurate are they. But I think overall, it's, the overlap is surprisingly small. So if you do your experiment with cDNA arrays, find genes that are different to expires. You repeat the experiment with AFI arrays, you get a very different result. Okay, so that's a big problem, right? I mean, for one thing, you're not sure if the results that you get are correct or not. And another thing is that eventually you'd like to, you know, combine data from different people, right? So if you, if someone else, you know, in another school has done, you know, a very similar experiment, then you don't want to, you know, and you want to see how your experiment compares with that, then you don't want to have to repeat their experiment. You like to just do your experiment on whatever platform you have and compare it against what someone else has done, which may not be on the same platform. And so this is a big issue, and it's, you know, far away from being settled. Just there are so many issues and problems, so that I think it'll be a while before these things get sorted out. So as I mentioned, AFI arrays appear to have the most reproducible experiment. You know, I think most people would, that have tried multiple hybridizations will say that they agree with correlation of 0.9899. But one thing I've done with Steve Greenberg, whom you met, I think, a couple weeks ago, is that we've studied how reproducible the data are between two generations of AFI arrays. So there is a very popular set of arrays. The first one was U95. That's 95 refers to the version of Unigene database that they use to collect the information about the probes. So that, I think, people used for a couple of years, lots of chips, I mean, many thousands of chips. And then U133 is the newer one. So U95 actually came in 5 chips, and U133 came in 2 chips. So, they changed a bunch of things, so they were able to fit into 2 chips. Now there is just a single chip with all the whole human genes. So, from 5 arrays 3-4 years ago, now you have a single array. And so a lot of experiments have been done. And these are human arrays. Just to give you a sense of how many arrays are out there, when I was talking to someone from Aventis Pharmaceutical, they have a proprietary database with, I think they said about, I can't remember, it was either 20,000 or 30,000 chips, right?
Of their own,
right? Their internal database. So 20,000, let's say, times $1,000, that's 20 million, right? It's a lot of money. So, anyway, so there's a lot of data using these arrays. I don't know if these arrays are not the one, they didn't have 20,000 of these arrays, but they have a lot of AFI arrays. These are 20,000 AFI arrays. And that's just one company. Anyway, so what Steve and I wanted to do was look at how the results would vary depending on which platform you use. And he actually had done the experiment on U95, and then he had a new grant, he had more samples, so he wanted to do it uniformly again, and so he did it on U133. And it's not because he had so much money that he just wanted to try this. So what he did was he hybridized 14 muscle biopsy samples from patients with inflammatory myopathies, which is his specialty. Then they were hybridized to both chips. So I looked at this data. We submitted the paper just recently. But what we looked at was what happens when we group the arrays using hierarchical clustering, which you know by now, and when we find differential expanse genes in each case. Okay. So you can't read the labels from there, I bet. But so if you look at the top left one, so we basically pulled all the data together and said, okay, just can I cluster them? So what you should see is, same sample hybridized to 95 and 133 should be next to each other, right? And that should be the case for all your samples. In this clustering, everything on the left is U133, and everything on the right is U95. Yeah. Okay, so if you cluster, it's not the sample characteristics, but the array type that is the distinguishing feature. Well, in this case, we use Pearson correlation, so any linear normalization would not affect the result. But no matter what you try, it's going to turn out this way. And so this is disturbing, right? So there are some ways to fix this. So in this particular case, we normalized the genes in a particular way, and then we were able to actually get this to line up correctly. But what we did in this case, in general, doesn't work. So we could only do it here, but in general it doesn't work. So remember, this is one platform, just different generations, right? So if you were to compare different platforms, things are just much harder. And so that's just an idea of that should give you some idea as to how different they are. Another way that we looked at was from each platform, we looked at So the samples were naturally divided into two groups. So we looked at, for each platform, what genes are differentially expressed. So from the 95 U95 samples, we got long list. From 133, we got a long list. Okay, how much overlap is there? Okay, that was the question. Okay, does that make sense? Okay. So if you look at the dotted line, if you look at right, so we had 14. Okay, and they were basically five of one type, and the rest were of another, could be considered as another type. Okay. So of the four, so using those five and nine chips, we looked at the differential expressed genes. Okay, so we do that separately for each one. So I mean, they should overlap, right? And this these are exactly same samples. Right? We did a lot of analysis to make sure that there wasn't a lot of degradation of RNA and such. But if you look at this, so forget the solid line for now. If you look at the dotted dashed line, out of top 100, there are about 20%, less than 20% that overlap. So about 20 genes will show up in both, but 80 genes are not in common. Okay. So that's a somewhat disturbing, right? I mean, if you look at top 50, and usually when investigators do these experiments, they can't really look at more than, top 20, 30, 50. It's about 15% that are in common. So 15%, that's like 7 or 8 genes out of 50. So that's somewhat disturbing, right? So we actually, for the paper, we actually found some way of fixing this problem in the general case. So we could raise the percentages a lot. But, most people who will not go through this trouble of what we did should be aware that their list is not all that robust. And in some sense, this is not surprising, although the degree to which that they disagree is surprising. Generally, you have, several hundred or maybe even thousands of genes that are differentially expressed. And there are, differentially expressed at a very similar level, right? So any perturbation that you make to the data, things are going to just, shuffle, and they'll be, they're generally not very stable. So it's not surprising that they don't agree very much. But in this case, because it was so tightly controlled, because we had the same RNA labeled at the same time, they were hybridized in the same facility, we expected this to be a little higher, but it's not. So this is a challenge, I think, and it should be a caution for people doing experiments. One thing that people should pay more attention to, therefore, is not so much what genes are expressed, but what kind of genes are expressed. So people are now thinking of more robust way of looking at the list. For example, what kind of goal category genes are represented at the top? That kind of thing. So that's a good question. So we looked at that in detail. So it turns out that if the probes, so you all know how AFI arrays work. So if the probes are exactly the same, the sequences are exactly the same, they are very reproducible. Okay, so they give very good results. But if they are different, I don't have pictures here to show you, but no relationship. Even though they are supposed to detect the same transcript. So basically, the lesson is that slight changes in the sequence information results in huge changes in your expression. Okay. No, the length is the same. The length, those are 25 mers, and the reason that they're, so there is a debate as to what the optimal length is. And so people have, so the commercial suppliers that I listed earlier, they have different lengths. So there are some 30 mers, 50 mers. A lot of people think that the longer oligonucleotides, usually of 70 mers or that size, are the best. But that's still a bit of an open question. But AFI would probably like to have longer probes, but they're limited by technology. So they are built by, you know, it's the same technology that you use to build semiconductor chips. And so you can't, you know, tile so many nucleotides. So so what they did, so the reason that AFI got better is that, I mean, this is, it's so hard to figure out exactly which sequences would give you the best result. So basically what AFI has done over the years is that throughout the generations, they figured out just by sort of trial and error which ones give bad results. And so they just, you know, next time the product comes out, they get rid of all the bad ones and just, you know, try new ones. So by that trial and error process, in my view, they've gotten pretty good. So if you look at, you know, 2-3 years ago, if you look at in the old chip, just how much variation there is on, you know, among the probes that are supposed to detect the same gene, you'd see just things all over the place. Just, you know, maybe half the probes may give you completely different numbers. But now it is much better. Things have certainly improved. And I think AFI is, the platform itself has some advantages because they are using some, you know, multiple probes. Other platforms, you know, they don't have the luxury of doing that, right? So they have single longer probe, but they have no idea whether it's correct or not. And I've looked at actually commercial arrays, not AFI, and compare that against AFI, and you just get disturbing results. So you know, you probably have heard of a lot of good things about microarrays, and that's probably true overall. I mean, it's, but there are some issues that you need to be careful about. Okay, so yeah, I was a little surprised about this, and I guess the recommendation is that if you have different platforms, at least, you know, unless you are able to go through what we went through, not to combine the arrays. But then that's not a very satisfactory solution, right? I mean, if you have a database with all these chips that everyone else has done, what good use, you know, what use is it if you can't use them other than just, you know, each data set in its own state. So okay, so I don't think we need to talk about how many chips we need. I don't know if anyone's planning to do array experiments. Your array experiments. Oh, okay. So generally, I think for most platforms that have been around for a while, most people would agree that biological variability dominates technical measurement errors. So for AFI, you don't want to do many replicates of the same, you know, tissue or sample, right? In terms of exactly how many you need, how many chips you need, that's a hard question. Only because you don't know how much variability that you have in your samples. So if someone can tell me, I have this much variability in my samples, you know, I want this false positive rate, this false negative rate, I can give you numbers based on some model. Okay. But usually people can't give me those numbers, so there's no point in talking about this. Some, in generally speaking, if you have data like cancer data where you have a lot of variability, I think people would say, some studies have said, you know, having samples like 10 to 15 per group for a two-group comparison might give you something like 75% false positive rate, so, and for detecting genes that are threefold variable. So, yeah, there can be some estimates like that for given parameters, but in general, it's hard. So, yeah, let's leave it at that. I think I'm going to skip most of these. I'm sure you've seen these before. Have you guys talked about PVIs, multiple testing? Okay, so maybe not. Okay, so just to give you one example. So suppose you flip a coin 10 times and get all heads, okay? This is like a, you know, statistics 101, you know, problem question. What's the probability that you get all heads, okay? And it turns out it's about, it's about 0.001, right? It's like 1/2 to the 2 to the 10, right? So, yeah, so it's about 0.1%. Okay, so if the question is it biased, say, probably, right? It's pretty unlikely. But what if there are 10,000 people flipping coins and one person gets 10 heads, right? So should you be surprised that someone got 10 heads? Probably not, right? So you need to adjust for this, right? This is the same problem that that I mentioned earlier with the Nature Genetics paper. You need to adjust for the fact that there are so many genes. In some sense, it is somewhat, people find it somewhat difficult to understand, because I'm interested in one gene, but if my probability depends on like what kind of chip I use, for example, if I use a chip with 10,000 genes versus a chip with 30,000 genes, okay, my conclusion will, or my probability will be different for the gene that I'm interested in. So people find it sometimes a bit hard to understand, but some correction has to be made. I think, so it's often referred to as multiple testing, adjustment. I think there is some consensus now on how to do this. So maybe we won't talk about this here. But people generally, and I agree with this as well. There's something called false discovery rate that you may have heard of. I think that's a very reasonable approach. Exactly how to calculate that is not so simple, but can be done. All right, so let's talk a little more about the subject that I'm interested in terms of application. So eventually, for people that are interested in sort of applications, clinical applications of microarray or any other type of high throughput data, is that you'd like to use this in your clinical setting, that is treatment related things. So the challenge is to stop doing these simple sort of methodological problems at some point and move on to real problems. And that means incorporating large amount of phenotypic data. So in a clinical setting, typically you have lots of other types of data listed here, and we like to find relationships between genomic data and phenotypic data. So questions could be, what genes or variables are correlated with a particular phenotype? What should be used as predictors? So I'm just introducing the sort of framework at a basic level, and then we'll look at some papers. So the most simple case that people have spent a lot of effort on is the binary case. So the phenotypic data, in this case, is just a label, right? 0, 1, yes or no, disease versus normal. And there are basically every methods out there that could be applied to this has been applied. And there's tons of papers on this, how to do this better, right? How do you pick out genes that are related to the label? And how do you do the prediction? Okay. Have you guys talked about prediction? Like how to, do you know what leave one out cross-validation is? Okay. All right, so good. And then people did multiple subclasses, right? Just not just two, but multiple cases. And then in this case, it's non-ordered, right? So you have just different subtypes. You could have an ordered subclasses. That is, if you have a rating for severity of disease, maybe you have one through five as your phenotype. Continuous. Okay. So for some reason, this hasn't really. The last two haven't been done as well as they should have been, or they should be. As well as they should be, but it's certainly in an area where a lot of progress needs to be made. So, for example, I did one collaboration where the phenotype was some invasive ability of cells. So what genes predict the ability of these cancer cells? And so how to apply through all this, finding genes and then finding predictions, predict prediction algorithms and then making predictions, how to do that optimally is not completely settled. And finally, the sensor data type is something that I'm very interested in, and I'll talk a little more about that later. Okay? So it turns out that a lot of these phenotypes can be reduced to the binary type. Okay? So I mean, if you have multiple subclasses, you can combine them into two. If you have continuous data, you can say, well, low invasive versus high. If you have severity of disease, you can divide it into two. So you can always turn into these into a simpler problem. And that's what people have done in many cases. But you lose a lot of information. So you like to preserve that and do that, carry the same procedure out. So, I mean, you probably have seen this before. There are lots of questions that could be asked and have been asked. So just to give you a sort of general framework, so because there are so many genes in the data, usually there is some type of dimensionality reduction. Even when you have a very good method, you still need to reduce the data set size. Sometimes, you know, unless you have a nice computer, things may not even fit on your data unless you do some sort of reduction. So this problem is called feature selection in computer science. So there are lots of different ways of filtering genes, you know, threshold value for minimum expression, variation filtering, and so on. There are lots of tools for doing the dimensionality reduction. So typically, either you reduce dimension by just cutting down the number of genes, or you could actually find some sort of linear combinations of genes and then use those as the reduced dimension. So if you do like principal components, you know, or single value composition, you reduce the dimension, but the dimensions that you have in the end are not genes, right? Those are combinations of genes. So there are different ways of doing this. And with disadvantages and advantages for each one. So I won't go through this, but you know, t-test you probably have heard of. So let me just spend maybe two, three slides on just one thing that a lot of people have noticed. This problem has been fixed in most cases, say starting a year or two ago. But if you go back to earlier papers, they've done a lot of suboptimal things, or in this case, just some wrong thing in their study. So there are a lot of papers on classifying disease categories, right? I mean, this has been the primary or one of the primary applications of AFI technology or cDNA technology. Of course, you know, the performance depends on the methodology used. You know, a lot of times you see these machine learning algorithms like support vector machines, neural networks, they appear to give pretty good results often. And as you probably know, if there are enough samples, you want to use sub-training and testing sets to assess your accuracy. If not, use Lieber-Nap cross-validation. It turns out that a lot of papers in good journals have made mistakes in prediction accuracy. And what they state are overestimates of the real accuracy. So this wasn't discussed by other people, right? Oh, he did. In breast cancer? Okay. All right, so let me do very briefly then. So let me just talk about this one simulation study. Did he talk about this? Okay. All right, so there's a Rick Simon at NIH. He's a statistician who's done a lot of good work. He published this paper. Actually, I think the date is, it may have been 2002. Anyway, Journal of National Cancer Institute. So he did a simulation study just to show you what kind of mistakes could be made. So he generated simulated data, 20 expression profiles, 10 randomly assigned to one class, the rest to the other. Okay. So in this case, because the data are all random, there's no true underlying differences, and that means whatever prediction you should make, you make, the error should be about half, right? And he averaged this procedure over 2,000 data sets. Okay. So resubstitution here means, okay, so you have 20 samples, so you build your model, prediction model, based on all 20, okay? So you have your model, and then you test the model on each one, okay? So if you do that, 98.2% of the time, you make no error, okay? You always get the labels correct, okay? Cancer or not, or whatever the labels you might be in a particular study, that's the label. So, you know, and you know, that's clearly a wrong thing to do, right? You can't build your model based on your data and then predict the data. But what a lot of people have done in good journals is to remove the test sample after gene selection. Okay, so I have my 20 samples, and then I filter the genes, you know, and then I pick the genes that are informative of the classes. Okay, and then to predict the model, I leave one out, or predict the label, I leave one out, build my model, but based on the genes that I've already selected, and then predict the one that's left out. Okay, then you leave another one out, build a new model to the prediction, okay, and so on. So you think, well, you know, that should be okay, right? But it's okay if the gene set that you get is the same every time you, if it were the same every time you delete a sample and recalculate, okay? But as we saw earlier, I mean, the gene list is not very stable. So if you do that, there's a lot of bias. So if you do that in this simulated data set, 90% of the time, on a random data set, you have 90% accuracy, right? So, I mean, generally the difference is not this big, but it could be substantial depending on, say, the size of your data set. Now, if you do it correctly, that is, you remove the data set before selection, right? Before selecting the genes, you reselect the genes and you do the prediction and so on. Then the median of, you get median of 11 misclassification, okay? About, so you should get 10, so you get something close to the same. Of course, no one really does it exactly the way it should be done. So the way it should be done is you delete one sample and then start everything from scratch. Like you renormalize, you do everything, right? But no one really does that, right? So they just actually normalize using all the data, and then, you know, nowadays you move one and then remove one to the gene selection and so on. So I think people probably suspected that there was a problem with this, but not as big as it is in certain cases. So nowadays, like if you see a paper in good journals, it'll have a supplementary information. They'll talk about what the bias is. But they often report the better rate, you know, in the paper. So, you know, not good. Okay, so let's talk about survival times now. So how many of you are familiar with, like, sensor data? Like, do you? Okay, so I won't really talk about the basics too much then. The sensoring rate often is in the order of, you know, it could be like 50%. That's not unusual. So you want to make sure that you take care of your sensoring correctly. And generally, we talk about the right sensoring, right? You have a patient, a study is terminated before patients die, your patient drops out of study. Okay, so as in the other phenotypes, the simplest thing you can do is to use standard univariate approach. That is, I look at my genes one at a time, see is this gene related to survival, right? So there are many ways of doing that because, I mean, this problem has been around for decades, and so there are good methods for doing this. For example, you know, log rank tests, you know, will give you some p-value as to how that gene is correlated with your survival data. And so a lot of papers will do that, some sort of univariate approach, considering one gene at a time, and then they put together at the end in some type of voting method. So to do a prediction on the patient, you know, you say, well, you know, what does my gene 1 say about this patient? What about gene 2? You know, what about gene 100? They sort of add up, you know, sometimes weighted differently depending on how good the gene is in predicting or in its correlation to the phenotype. So as I'll talk a little more later, this is often not optimal. So, I mean, it's how people do it because it's easy, but it's not optimal. Let me skip that. So let's just do some, take a look at some examples. So eventually, you'd like to do your study and then correlate that with your phenotype, and then actually go on to show that whatever, you don't want to just show that it's related to the phenotype, right? You want to show that it's better than what people use currently, right? So this wasn't done until, you know, like say 2001, 2002. So people just said, oh, my expression profiles are related to my phenotype, okay? But is it actually better? So it's actually, I guess this is an interesting question for debate. I mean, people have published all these papers for, you know, 2-3 years, but I actually don't know of any hospital that will do the testing and then do prediction on the patient, right? I mean, there was some report of a plan to do this in Netherlands, but, you know, this hasn't really come about. So, I mean, I actually had a good friend in the pathology department who's actually done a lot of arrays himself. And so now that he finished his MD, PhD, he's doing a pathology fellowship, he said, okay, you know, maybe I'll try to get this thing to the clinic. And it turns out there's a lot of problems, right? For one thing, a lot of these studies have not shown that compared to the cost involved, that it's actually a good deal, right? So apparently there are very simple tests for a lot of, say, cancer-related diagnosis. There are very simple tests that are very cheap and very easy to do. Take, you know, very little time. So he said it's not clear in the clinic whether those tests are actually, you know, less accurate than this. It's much simpler. People already do this, and so there isn't a great incentive to switch to this. And probably the bigger reason though is money, right? So insurance companies these days are paid by paid per patient, right? So I forget the terminology for this, but so if the hospital wants to do an extra procedure like this test, basically they don't get reimbursed by the insurance company unless it can be shown to the insurance company that this is, you know, a necessary procedure to be done on all these patients. Okay. And that's a difficult thing. I mean, so my friend looked into this, and it's not easy, right? Hospital or insurance companies are not willing to, you know, shell out money unless it's, you know, proven sort of in a reasonably, you know, good way. And of course, you know, if I were to, for example, show them the earlier results on how irreducible these are, no one's going to say I'm going to pay $1,000 per patient. So I don't know where, you know, at what point this is going to really be done in the clinic. So, but I think as more people publish better papers and do a more comprehensive cost-benefit analysis, you know, maybe it will happen. I think initially people are very excited that this is, you know, what you're going to do, right? You walk into the clinic, they do this, and, you know, give you all these diagnoses, but who knows when this is going to happen. Those are some practical issues that that are not so easy to resolve. In any case, this is a paper that came out in Nature. This is, I think, a group from the Netherlands where I think they are more, at least from a couple articles that I've read, there are more closer to actually doing this in the clinic. And one article actually cited this paper, the result of this paper, as a basis for doing this in clinic. So one problem is that I don't think what was done in this paper is that great, so that's a bit of an issue. But at least in this paper, they claim that this gene expression profile will outperform all currently used clinical parameters in predicting disease outcome in certain blood cancer. So is anyone familiar with this paper? Okay. Who? Oh, Steve?
Yeah.
All right. So did he talk about methodology as well? Oh, okay. I must have forgotten. Did he talk about this paper as well? It's also a breast cancer paper. Okay. But so you talked about this paper, but not... let's see which paper. Okay. I apologize. I was trying to remember from last year what papers were covered, and I knew that the lymphoma papers were covered by Zach or somebody, but then I forgot that Steve might have covered this. Okay. Anyway, so actually, there isn't that much time, so it's good that he covered this. So basically, the approach is you build some sort of classifier, right? You pick out the genes, build some sort of classifier, and then, so the way that these papers prove that, you know, things are good, the expression profiles are better, is that you do some sort of Kaplan-Meier plot for each one, and then you do a log rank test or, you know, some test like that to show that there's a big difference, right? So they do this for a variety of stratified groups. So you might take patients that were assigned one category of disease by your typical prognosis, and then you show that within that group there's enough variability. Right? So somehow that, you know, there is some information in the expression data that's not captured by this. And the next step that are done increasingly now is after you get this classifier, you put that together with all the other data, right? So in this case they have one basically out of all the expression data that they have, they just come up with one signature, right? So yes, it looks good versus no, it doesn't. And so that becomes just a one variable in your multivariate model that you have. So typically, most studies without expression data will just have a multivariate model, Cox model, sometimes. So Cox model is just a multiple linear regression sort of done differently for sensor data. So for Cox model, you fit everything. And then if you see that the p-value is small for that, then you say, well, you know, it's a new parameter or new variable that you should take into account in your study. So I think this is a fairly reasonable approach. There's another study, you may have seen this as well, where they do something better, I think, which is after you get all your expression data, they actually manually go through the top genes and then try to come up with new variables. So I think this, you know, good signature versus bad signature is too crude, right? It doesn't really give you as much information from the data. I think you could get, a lot of, more information from your expression data. So in this example, they actually have not yes or no score, but they actually have a prediction score. Okay, so that's, a continuous variable. And then they actually classify their genes, depending on their expression profiles and their sort of known annotations into these groups. So in this case, they have five groups. So proliferation signature value, this is a set of genes. BMP6, that's just one gene that just happened to be different from all the other profiles. And then they have these signature values. So I think this is a fairly reasonable approach, and I think it gives you a lot more information. Plus, these coefficients, right, I think give you sort of a more robust view of, how that expression, that group of genes is impacting your survival in this case. Okay? So you get a prediction score, and then I guess from here you could do, you could put other things, other variables in this setting, in the regression setting. Okay? Actually, there's a paper that came out this past week, right? This week. So, and you're smiling.
No.
Huh?
I know this one.
Oh, you know this one. Okay. So, I feel like at some point, someone can write a software, right, where you enter the data set and it'll just do all the things that are done, because it's, I think, fairly similar in all the papers, except the algorithms, basically the algorithm, the choice of algorithms used is like, who the investigator knows, right, who knows how to do these things, right? So in this case, there's Tipshirani is a statistician at Stanford, and so this paper uses the methods that he developed, which I think is a fairly good method. So just to give you a rough idea, what they do here is, they make predictions in the end. So they select genes by the method that Tipshirani developed, which is, actually, it's a little complicated to explain, but it basically does a search through all your space of genes, but you can also actually look for combinations of genes. So, if you remember, all the typical methods will look for a gene that's related to the phenotype. So, if there's any interaction between genes, you basically lose them all. Okay. So there is some fancy method that Hewitt developed where you basically search through all your genes. It's like regression, sort of stepwise regression type, where you basically search through your genes, you keep the one that gives you the best information, and then you try next set, and then you try combinations and that kind of thing. So they identify a bunch of genes, then they do a prediction. So they had 116 adults. You have one group, a training set with 59, you do a prediction on 57. The way they do the prediction is an algorithm that was published in PNAS a year or two ago. Basically, you look at, you take a new sample and then see which of the clusters the profile is closest to. But they do this in a slightly sort of clever way. So, so instead of just looking at correlations, they do something a little bit fancier. But the underlying idea is the same. And then they do the multivariate analysis, gene expression predictor was strongly independent prognostic factor. Okay. So this is a figure in the paper. I guess at this point. We'll skip this. So for the next, actually, about 5-10 minutes, let me talk about something that I did. So most studies so far used survival curves as a way of verifying the results. So you basically do the clustering, unsupervised clustering, and then you define groups and say, are they really different? Okay, so if they're really different, as verified by these curves, then you say, "Oh, that's great." Okay, but in some sense, this is sort of an indirect way of doing things, right? I mean, if maybe there's a different way of clustering that gives you a better result. Who knows, right? I mean, this is just kind of checking to see if your clustering was done correctly. And another way, another problem with this is that that's, I think, one way of doing things. Another way, actually, to do the censoring is, as was done in a lot of the other papers, is to turn survival times into binary indicator, as I mentioned. So something that we were interested in was whether there is some combination, right? So maybe it's not really gene A that's predictive, but it's gene A plus half of gene B plus two times gene C. Maybe that's not really the most predictive of survival time, right? So there's no, otherwise you're just, you don't know exactly how to combine your genes, right? If you do some sort of voting method, for example, it's not, you could sort of do it, you are combining information from all your genes, but you're not doing it in an optimal way. So we actually thought about this problem and then came up with what I think is a good solution. Of course, the difficulty is that it's too complicated, and so it's hard to write a software that someone can use, you know, to just press a button and get a good result. So, and I can't just, you know, we can't just do analysis for other people. So, as in many bioinformatics algorithms, it's kind of there, but we haven't really done as much as we could have done with it. So, just to give you a brief overview of this. So the basic problem is that you have too many variables, right? So we use some method, it's called partial least squares. It's actually becoming very popular now. And it turns out that it's a compromise between just doing least squares, like your regression, versus PCA. So principal component analysis is good in that you try to maximize information contained in your few components, but it doesn't really have anything to do with the phenotype, right? So if you pick variables based on PCA, you do a dimension reduction in some optimal way, but it may not be related to your phenotype. If you do regression, okay, you are picking something that's really tightly correlated with your phenotype, but you're not really doing any dimension reduction, or you can't do it in an optimal way. So there's something called partial least squares that's sort of a compromise between the two, and it appears to work really well in most cases. And it turns out that someone had worked this out, so they figured out how to do partial least squares for, you know, different types of phenotypes, continuous and binary phenotype. So it gets a little complicated, you know, as soon as you have a phenotype that's not binary, but as soon as it's not continuous. But it has been worked out. But when you have censoring, if you have a small number of genes, you could use something like Cox model to correlate gene expression to censoring. But when you have too many genes, you can't do that. Your standard method fails. So the question was, can we do this, right? Can we apply a method that's well known to work for a regular, just other simpler phenotype, but can we get this to work for sensor data? So it turns out that we came up with a fairly good solution. It turns out that this was worked out, you know, many years ago, we discovered, but there was no need, they didn't have high throughput data, so there was no need to use this. It was done by a statistician, and it's very hard to understand. I mean, I can barely understand it myself. In some extent, it was reinventing the wheel, but we do it a little differently, and then we were able to apply this. So it turns out that we were actually able to get some really good results. For example, if I use the results of that algorithm to divide the patients into different groups, then it's more significant than using some other method of doing things. So there are methods like this that could be, I think that will be available, and unfortunately, it does require some sort of mathematical training, but, you know, for people here that are interested in this and can invest the time and energy, I mean, I think knowing that the better algorithms will give you a lot of insights into what's going on underneath your data.
Because there are just so many games involved, and you just had a random expression values in survival.
Right.
Couldn't you just find a predictor, and,
Well, that's the problem, right?
Because it's just so many genes will always be a combination that will predict, even if they're randomly distributed, and the pattern has nothing to do with the survival that you can always find.
But not as well, right? Right. Yeah. But it's actually not that likely if you actually do the calculation. Yeah, but you could find some, right? You could find some combinations that will, and it's true for anything, right? But even for the binary case, right? You know, if you have 10 in each group, what's the probability that you're going to find a random predictor that will be lined? If it's continuous data, right, that will be lined up exactly as in the order of the patients. It's not that likely, yeah. So if it's not binary, right, it's much less likely.
You would think the binary would be
30,000. Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, and that's the problem, right? Even for these Kaplan-Meier curves that people show, they need to adjust for multiple testing in some way, right? Right, so you can certainly find genes that will give you a p-value, significant p-value, even though the data are random. So some people do permutation tests to adjust for the p-value. Conclusions, I don't need to go over that here. Let's see. So just as a final comment, to summarize briefly, I would say that some of the recent papers have done it pretty well, I think, analysis. I think that involves not just doing the typical, you know, cluster and then find the p-value for the Kaplan-Meier curves, but actually getting a good sort of score of some sort and then incorporating that into your multivariate model. And then, that part is actually not trivial, but if you're familiar with a statistical package, something like this, it is actually not hard. So, you know, you should be able to, I think, you know, if you understand these papers really well, and there are a lot of little steps that you have to worry about, you know, you should probably be able to do everything your own, I think. So, without too much difficulty. So finally, the software that I use all the time is R. Are you familiar with the software? Okay. What statistics software do you know, if any? Do you guys know MATLAB? Okay. So MATLAB, a lot of people know. So R is. So if you go to statistics department, they'll use one of two softwares. One is at SAS. A lot of people use that. And the other one is S plus. So SAS has been around forever. It's like Fortran, right? It's been around forever. There's a lot of people that have written good software for it. You know that it works, but it's very clumsy, right? A lot of things that you want to do, you can't do. They have a better Windows-driven package now for SAS, but even just a few years ago, like it will draw plots like using asterisks on a, you know, text kind of page, right? So the draw little characters on your screen as a plot. But I think the younger sort of generation that are more computer savvy are more likely to use S plus, unless they have to use SAS in their statistics courses. So S plus is more like MATLAB, so it's fairly powerful, and it gives you a lot of freedom. And R, the reason it's called S plus is there's a statistics language called S. I don't know why it's called S. Why C, programming language called C. And this was developed at Bell Labs, and you know, some company took the code and then made that as a product, and they called it S plus. And then now there's a bunch of people, a lot of whom are familiar with S, that developed R. So actually, the guy that wrote one of the two co-authors of the original R is at Dana-Farber, and he's been doing a lot of work in microarray analysis as well. But so the software R is free, and it's like Linux. You know, people contribute. It's well tested and very powerful, and that's what I use all the time. There are some issues like memory management and certain data types, but I think things are improving, and so I'm quite happy with it. And everyone that I've recommended it to are pretty happy with it. It has a feel of MATLAB, like you don't declare variables, you just kind of use them. Matrix manipulations are very similar. Everything's done in vector form. I showed this to one guy in one of the labs at the Children's Hospital. He's a fellow, and then he was trying to do some microarray data analysis in Excel, like doing some sort of permutation. And I showed him how to do this, and he said, this one line. I mean, it took me 3 hours to do this in Excel. And this is one line in R. Right? He was very happy. MATLAB has more statistics, but I think R has more sophisticated statistics. So MATLAB is more sort of engineering oriented. MATLAB has better graphics. It's probably better for solving for algorithms. Like if you want to solve a large matrix, it's probably better in MATLAB. Just because a lot more people are working with MATLAB, and it's a big company, they spend a lot of money on it. But for statistics routines, I think R is more more sophisticated. You have a lot more options. I used to use MATLAB all the time, but now I'm happy with R. But if you know one, it's easy to pick up the other. You always get confused as to, how do I comment something out, or, that sort of thing. But they're basically the same flavor, the same reason that MATLAB was popular. Let's see, steep learning curve, but worthwhile in the long run. And there's something called Bioconductor. I don't know if anyone has heard of this. So this was an effort that that Robert Gentleman, who's at the Dana-Farber Institute, who was one of the founders of R, started. So I was kind of more part of it, this project before, he suggested at the very beginning for the title or for the name of the project, MADMAN, like Microarray Data Management. But in the end, it was decided that NIH would not want to fund something called MADMAN. So he came up with Bioconductor, which is a much better name. So if you go to bioconductor.org, there are packages that you can download. So what's happening now is that this package has sort of caught on, so that if someone writes or comes up with a good algorithm, they'll write a R routine and deposit it somewhere in this website so that you can download it and run it. So and that's been done for a lot of good algorithms out there. So if you want to normalize your cDNA data using some fancy method, it's there. Download it. It's pretty easy. So, and there's a Windows version of this that's pretty easy. R comes in Linux and Windows, but it gets compiled for, gets ported to Windows frequently, and I've had no problems with it. I think someone was trying to port it to Apple, but I don't know how successful it is. I wouldn't recommend it. But I'm pretty happy with it. This is what I use all the time. This is what a lot of people use who do microarray analysis. Okay, so I see that I ended 3 minutes early. So. Yeah, so the problem with. Yeah, there is. The problem is that I think R is just a bad name because you can't really search for R. Yeah. You can go to Bioconductor R and there's a link back to R. Or you can do, if you do statistical package R, R used to be, I mean, it used to be hard to, like, run these things, but Robert and his friends have really made this easy so that you basically click a button and it'll install on your Windows. So, all right.